The August meeting of the Morro Bay Public Works Advisory Board will please come to order. Let the record show that all members are present. We'll have a moment of silence. Okay, does everyone accept the agenda? No objections? Anyone have any announcements?
Yes.
Susan?
Hi, I'm Susan Shaw, and I have an announcement. He was going to put it up. It's up? Excuse me. I would like to announce that the Morro Bay Community Foundation, which presents youth scholarships for children in Morro Bay, the Estero Bay area, is having our second Rock to Rock annual 5-mile fun run. And it's going to be the weekend of the Harbor Festival. And there will be T-shirts and the registration to register. You can go to active.com. And or you can pre-register by going through the Parks and Rec Department. And we'd like to encourage everyone to come out to this fun run, and it will benefit our youth for scholarships for the Parks and Recreation. Thank you.
Anyone else have any announcements? None? Okay. On written communications, we have one from the Morro Bay Bike Committee. I saw Robert Davis at Mike's Barbershop last Tuesday, and he said that he can't be here for report next month, but he will be here in October. Do we have any public comments? No?
I have a question.
You have a question on the bikes thing? Okay, go ahead.
Robert mentioned at this meeting we discussed, I was present at that meeting as well, there's an issue with safety as far as bike path use is on Quintana northbound right before you go under the freeway overpass, that if you're coming down the hill on a bicycle in the right-hand lane, apparently what's supposed to happen, there's a bike path on the west side of the street that's relatively new. If you're coming down the hill on Main Street, and you get to the Quintana and Main Street intersection, what you're supposed to do is get off your bike, push a walk button, walk across the street, push another walk button, but northbound to get over to that bike path, it just isn't a practical solution. And I think it's a huge liability because kids are, if they're on their way, I would love to see all the kids from Morro Bay High School ride their bikes, or even a good portion of them. That is the route they would take if they live at the south end of town. They're going to come down Main Street, and ideally they get on that bike path, and then they take a nice bike path right over to the high school. And I just think it's not a safe intersection. I'm not in the teenage years anymore, and I don't like to come down and press a button and walk across again. And so I know that reconfiguring that whole intersection would be quite a challenge. I think there could be something better done there, but in the meantime, I had a couple ideas about what could be done to make it safer, such as striping the lanes to make that left-hand turn lane. There's a pocket across from Lemus, and it's a left-hand turn lane, and I think if the paint is all worn off, and if you come down Main Street and you get into that left-hand turn pocket, you're sitting there and people are coming off the freeway, and they look at you like, what are you doing in the middle of the road there? Because they can't even tell there's a lane to turn. So I think that's a relatively inexpensive modification that would help, is to get that area lined. And then the other thing is, maybe as people are coming off the freeway, there could be a sign, watch for bicyclists, something to alert them, because they're making a right-hand turn off that off-ramp onto Main Street, and they're in a hurry because they're looking at cross-traffic coming from under the overpass. They're looking to their left. the bicyclists would be in that turning pocket on their right, and they're just wanting to make a quick right-hand turn. Well, you know, the bicyclist is trying to turn this way, and they're not even looking for bicyclists. So even though they do have right-of-way over the bicyclists in the left-hand turn lane, if they had an awareness somehow that bicyclists are there, I think that would be helpful. So I just really think that it's a safety issue, that maybe those two little things, like add a little bit of signage for the people on the off-ramp and get those lines restriped, would be a step in the right direction. Ultimately, I think there's got to be a better solution. I don't know what that would be exactly, but I think the bike lane was great, that the addition of that, but it, like I said, it only really serves those going on the southbound side of the road. Are you familiar with that, Dylan, that intersection? And
yeah, what I do, I actually, I ride that way quite a lot. We ride our kids down to the park.
Mm-hmm.
Coming from the south, we actually cheat, and so at Surf Street is usually where we cross, or we'll mm-hmm. cross at Beach and then just mm-hmm. come down the sidewalk there. So that we avoid that whole intersection. But I will pass this issue on to Rob Leivick, and I'm
okay.
sure he'll take a look at it.
Okay. I have a comment about what your alternative is, and I have done that as well, and I know other people do. But if you're trying to come down from Surf Street down to that intersection, they've put in signals and signs, and the sidewalk is impeded. And it's hard to maneuver even down that sidewalk, as I'm sure you know. It's not like a straight shot down the sidewalk, and it's two-way traffic. There can be people coming up on bikes as well or walking, and it's not that wide, and then you got all these posts. So, and I don't think we want people crossing Main Street, you know, up at the top of the hill either. I don't think that's great, and then coming down. But that what people will do is find alternatives because it isn't safe down there. You know, and but again, high school kids don't have their parents with them to point that out and encourage them to do that. So I think now that school's going back in session and hopefully kids are riding again, that we could maybe see some kind of improvement there. So you'll pass that on to Rob?
Yeah, so
okay.
Then he's the city engineer who would make any kind of determination about striping changes, signage, that kind of thing. So I'll pass it on to Rob Leivick.
Okay, and then how would I know that he has gotten that information?
You're welcome to follow up with him. I'll get it to him.
Okay.
I'd like to add something to this conversation, if I may. There's also a no crosswalk paint where the east side of Main Street goes under the freeway, under Highway 1, and crosses across to the Lemos parking lot area. There's no crosswalk there. So anyone walking under the underpass on the sidewalk comes to an abrupt halt and has to kind of dart across the freeway, not the freeway on-ramp, the southbound freeway on-ramp at Main Street. Also, anyone coming from the Harbor Tract, when I lived there for several years, would walk from the Harbor Tract or south of Highway 1 on Main Street, crossing using the... There's a striped area where the cars, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. are looking left mm-hmm. to turn right, because mm-hmm. it's right turn only there, to join, That's mm-hmm. where...
Is there stripage now at that on-ramp that's worn off? Or is there nothing there for pedestrian crossing?
On the on-ramp, there's
no... At the on-ramp, there isn't even a sidewalk?
I don't think there's any line there.
Oh.
No.
Well, Dylan, because of the interaction with Caltrans and the highway there, we would run into problems with those intersections with striping with Caltrans, correct?
There are limitations. So as you come down at that location specifically, you can see where Caltrans thinks they stop because they've done an overlay project. I know Rob was holding off on doing striping there. That was one of the places he intended to get to with his overlay project, was that little section down through there. And so it doesn't surprise me that the striping's not in the best of shape. We kind of knew some work was coming up there. Now that he knows it's being pushed off, I would imagine he'll get in there and do what he can.
Yeah, that's great, and maybe we could incorporate some of this to that. That'd be great.
Anyone else?
Yeah, Dylan, is there any plan to do any striping at all this year? Because there was some done last year, and that striping all down through Quintana, I know that was supposed to get paved, but the striping is gone on the west side of Quintana in front of that development project that's been abandoned or whatever. and all the way down in front of Taco Bell, there's hardly any lines left at all for the bike paths. Is there any striping that's planned at all, or is this something we're going to have to try and push to get done?
I'm not aware of any plans for striping, but that's not something I would necessarily be aware of. That would be something that Rob and his crews would work out, sort of what work tasks they're doing next. So when you have concerns like that, the best way to deal with it is basically send an email or come by the office and just let Rob Livick know. He's the one that will sort of coordinate and schedule that work.
I have one other comment on this letter from the bike committee, and that has to do with the third paragraph, and they're talking about the class one bike path that goes from the cloisters to the high school, goes next to the high school and then comes out and crosses Highway 41. What the bike committee talked about doing was they want to sign it so that pedestrians, and let's see if I can get this right. It doesn't make sense to me. There's a class one bike trail with a stripe down the middle. And in my mind, when you're on a bike trail, everybody stays to the right, pedestrians or bicyclists. And if you're passing, you go around to the left. And you can see who's coming at you, and you maneuver. And I ride a lot in the Bay Area where they have a lot of bike class one bike trails like that and a lot of use. And it works really well. What the bike committee wants to do is they want to make it so that everybody, let's say everybody's northbound on the bike trail, that the bikes stay on the right, but the pedestrians are on the left going north. And that's what they want to sign that area to say. I think it's confusing. I don't think it's a good idea. And the logic is, like on streets, when you're a pedestrian, you're supposed to walk facing traffic, not with traffic. So their logic is that the people that are walking, everybody southbound would be walking this way and bike right. I can't keep it straight because it doesn't make sense in my mind. But anyway, do you understand what I'm saying? It's like opposite.
Yeah, they're trying
of how
to get pedestrians to walk left and bicyclists to ride right.
Right.
And it sort of seems like the English system for the pedestrian.
Yeah. And so my comment would be, and I will go to this next meeting that they have, but I don't think that makes sense to most people. I think it'll just confuse them if they try to sign it that way. I think when you're on a bike path, everybody just stays to the right. Whichever direction you're going, you stay to the right and you pass to the left. So it says in here that they're going to talk to Mr. Ambo about it. So I would like it if you could pass on to Mr. Ambo that I don't know about the rest of you, if you're in agreement about this.
I agree. I thought the same thing when I read it.
I'm kind of confused. Mm-hmm. Is there a southbound side? So there's two separate bike paths,
no.
A northbound and
no.
A southbound?
It's one pathway.
Okay, divided in half, then divided in quarters.
No, it's just kind of one pathway. Totally. And people go both directions on that one pathway.
It's got a stripe down the middle.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, then I agree with you.
Oh. So if you could pass it on, that at least several of us agree that that might be more confusing than helpful, even though that technically may be right.
Okay, that's it.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll proceed to the consent calendar. We have the minutes of the last meeting. Anybody have any changes? If not, I will accept the motion to accept. And second, as measured by one water meter in 1 month. You will notice that the rate chart is a progressive rate system, whereas a customer uses more water, the cost of all of the units consumed increases. The council adopted this system as a method of discouraging high water use. The basic method for measuring the water, the quantity of water consumed, is the unit. And a unit is 100 cubic feet of water, which is 748.05 gallons. Each water customer has a water meter that measures the amount of water flowing to that property. The meter reads in units and is read once a month. The water customer is billed once per month for the number of units consumed during the previous month. Note that I've added a column 4 to the water rate chart titled City Cost. This is the actual cost to the city to deliver the designated amount of water to the consumer. You'll note that not until we get to 8 units does the billing exceed the cost to the city. the lowest charge of $16.43 a month for 0 to 3 units was adopted as a courtesy to low-income residents. So we also have, of course, many rental units, vacation houses that only use a low amount of water like that, and therefore they're billed in that same category. Over the years, we've had many complaints from residents in the $16.40 rate bracket that they are being overcharged and that they are paying for the water they do not use. In reality, just the opposite is true. They are paying less than it costs the city to deliver the water to them. When one buys a bottle of water in the market, the price paid includes the cost of obtaining the water, its treatment, packaging, marketing, transportation, whatever profit is involved. In the case of any city, an extensive infrastructure installation is required before a drop of water can be delivered to the customer. For Morro Bay, the total cost of the water system includes the pipes under the streets, the fire hydrants, the state water pipeline, the bond payments, the meters, maintenance, labor, and other costs that add up to a figure when divided by the number of meters in use, comes to $38.50 per customer per month. Now, this figure is the cost 9 years ago in the year 2000. The cost must be somewhat more today, but an updated figure is not available. To this must be added the actual cost of the water to enable us to determine the total cost to the city to deliver a given quantity of water to the customer. The city has a board that meets once a month to resolve the problems of customers who develop large water bills due to leaks or other reasons. The board uses the real cost numbers to remove the social engineering from the bill and establish a charge that is satisfactory to both the city and the customer. Most of the Morro Bay's water comes from the state water system. The water comes from the state aqueduct, which you know is over in the San Joaquin Valley there, and it proceeds from there to the Paloma Pass water treatment plant, which is near Shalom, where the water is processed to a very high standard. The water then enters a southbound pipeline, transporting the water to all state water users as far south as Santa Barbara. A branch pipeline, originating up at the Cuesta Grade, brings the water to Cuesta College and the Men's Colony. From there, a pipeline owned by Morro Bay brings the water to us. Morro Bay has contracted to receive 1,313 acre-feet of state water per year. This water comes from the county's yearly allotment of 25,000 acre-feet. During dry years, the state may deliver a reduced amount of water to its customers, and Morro Bay has a safety contract with the county to provide up to 200% additional water when reduced amounts are being delivered. Thus, the state can deliver as low as 33% of normal, and Morro Bay will still get its 1,313 acre-feet. This comes from state water the county has that no one has contracted for. Our state water is of very high quality. Our local groundwater is substantially harder. This is due to the fact that groundwater picks up minerals and other, also taste, and other elements present in the soil and rocks through which the water permeates. It can also be contaminated by nitrogen from fertilizers applied to the surface above, as we've recently seen with the Morro Creek water. Our third source of water is our desal plant, which converts brackish or seawater to nearly distilled water purity by the reverse osmosis process. Used at full capacity, this plant can produce about 45% of our yearly water needs. The only negative is operating cost. The plant uses about 28 kilowatt hours of electricity to produce 1,000 gallons of pure water. Now, this is because we have pumps that pump the water to a high pressure, it's about 1,000 pounds per square inch, which forces it through the reverse osmosis units. Then added to the water bill is a sewer charge. Now, some people look at that and think this is the water bill. It isn't. It's a separate item. It goes only to operate the and maintain the sewer plant and to pay for the upgrade needed to meet the federal requirements. Now, you may have some questions, and Bonnie Johnson is graciously here.
I have a question. Thank you for coming. And thank you, Bill, for preparing this. This is very interesting. Thank you for putting this together. Really interesting. And I'm curious how many units an average individual would use per month.
Kind of what Bill has established and the Water Review Committee has established is about the average family of four in the city of Morro Bay uses on average about 7 units per month. And it can go up depending on your water habits. I do have at city how much they used given a yard, laundry facilities, and for people, daily showers, laundry, dishwasher, that kind of thing.
I have a question. I think of myself as I'm a conservationist with water and everything. When you said 7, that's lower than what I use, and I'm only one person. You've mentioned that you have a board that meets, or how do you get someone to come out to see, to give you suggestions or whatever, because I'm shocked. I figured out my average based on this wonderful report you did, Bill, and I figured out over 17 months I was averaging about 8. I had some months that were as low as 2, and my highest month was I even once got up to 15. So I'm embarrassed to say that, but I think I even put buckets in my shower and catch the water as it comes out when it's cold, thinking I'm, you know, saving water. And so I'm really shocked because I think I do my best to save water.
The Water Review Committee was basically established to help people if they do have a leak that occurred during the month, a hose left on, a leaking toilet, that kind of an instance, because they will only review your account 2 times for the life of your account. And so it's not something that you can go to on a regular basis. And they will also only take 2 to 3 months into consideration for any relief that they do give you, considering if a toilet was leaking or a landscaping type of issue that you didn't catch right away. So it's not something they will review for an entire year's worth of period of time. Anybody can call me at City Hall, and I'll spend as much time as you need giving you ideas of ways that you can cut down and find leaks within your house. Toilets and irrigation are the biggest culprits for high water use, and a lot of people don't realize. Leaky toilets is not something you're going to hear on a constant basis. There's quite a few people who've I've suggested putting just a drop of food dye in the tank of your toilet. The color should stay there until you flush your toilet. If any color goes to the bowl of your toilet, there's obviously something going on. I was just speaking to an individual the other day who every 5 to 10 minutes he hears water draining from his tank to his toilet 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and he and his family of four are using about 15 units per month, which is on average about 350 gallons to 400 gallons a day. That you're using, and it's very revealing. The wax ring, if that's not properly sealed, is going to be constantly pulling water from your tank to your bowl, and that happening 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is going to make your water use substantially higher. Broken sprinkler heads in your landscaping. A lot of people have their landscaping running in the middle of the night to conserve on their water use, and so you're not going to see if you have a broken sprinkler head in the middle of the night, or irrigation systems, that landscaping timers, if you don't have a battery backup in those or a working battery, if you have a power outage, a lot of those revert back to manufacturer settings, which are about 20 minutes a day every day. And I'm sure John can verify about 10, 15 minutes 2 to 3 times a week is very adequate for this area. We don't have a lot of heat that dries out your landscaping on a regular basis. We actually have quite a few moist mornings. So 10 to 15 minutes, 2 to 3 times a week is very adequate for your landscaping here.
So what should somebody like me do? Is there a water police I could call and have them come over and help? Because I don't know how to do these things. I really don't.
Well, Susan, you may have an intermittent leak, because you said you were low sometimes and then other times up. So you may have an intermittent, which could be possible. And check
so
that
do
out.
I call a plumber? Or?
Well,
I mean, really, I'm sure there are a lot of people out there like me who are very helpless when it comes to their home.
Yeah.
And I'm one of them. So
we'll talk about it later. Anybody else?
I just wanted to make a comment that in our household, which is two people, we are often at 10 units a month, and I've checked everything. We do have extensive landscaping, but it's drip, and it's, you know, low flow drip. So I feel like maybe that 7 units for a family of four with landscaping, it seems maybe a little unrealistically low. I don't know. But I do know when I was trying to figure out why our bill is higher than what you just suggested, when I called, you were very, very helpful on the phone. Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I was so happy to see you here tonight, because I think it's great if people know that they can call you, and you had some very specific things to try to find out what was going on with a higher usage. So it's a mystery. We're still working on it at our house. I think it probably has to do with our irrigation system, and we're still at closer to 10, 11 units a month. So I'm going to keep searching. But I definitely recommend to people to call Bonnie and ask her for specifics on how to do that search. And you were very helpful and friendly and gave me plenty of time. So thank you.
Well, as most of you know, I'm on the Water Bill Review Board. And we met this morning, as we meet the third Wednesday every month, like this meeting. But the most frequent reason we have for excessive water use is the automatic sprinklers in the yard. It's the solenoid valves, and they're too darn cheap. That's the reason. A good solenoid valve that will be, an industrial-grade valve that's made to function right along costs maybe $120. And, of course, a lot of these valves that you buy in the hardware store are like $10. Well, they're made to fail, and you're going to have a big water bill as a result because they stick open, see, and let the water run, and you don't know it. But that's the most common problem we have.
Bonnie, so if somebody suddenly gets a $200 or $300 water bill one month, all they need to do is call you or somebody down there in the office, and then you're at the city's mercy to basically figure out what they're going to do? Or does somebody need to write a letter in? Because I know in Los Osos there's a different procedure. The water customer is a little more responsible to save themselves.
Basically, you can write a letter addressed to the Water Review Committee explaining what happened, what you did to fix the problem, and then you can mail it in to the same place that you mail your water bill to. And what they request is that you pay, like if you do receive a $300 water bill, or, they've had a couple people with $2,000 water bills, pay what you normally pay so that they see that you are interested in keeping in good faith with your water account. And then they meet the third Wednesday of every month, and then they make any adjustment to the account, and then after that, whatever balance is remaining on your account needs to be paid basically immediately, or if need be, payment arrangements can be made, 2 to 3 payments. But basically, give me a call, let me know kind of what happened, and I can give you direction from there. But a letter explaining what happened usually is sufficient.
But what I think I heard you say earlier is the lifetime of your account, you only get 2 times that you can have the option to have the board review your
yes.
account. That's right.
Yes.
But you can call you and talk to you about how to find the problem
I'm
as
there.
Often as needed.
I'm there 8 to 5,
okay.
Monday through Friday.
I have a question, Bonnie. For the people out there watching the show, when they watch it, when they talk about water, sometimes people don't understand that they're paying not just for water but for sewer, and now with the upgrade for the sewer plant, I know you probably get a lot of calls talking about that. For people who are low water usage, could you explain in a minute, explain to us what the basic use for maybe 1 or 2 units, and then plus the sewer, so people kind of understand. I mean, looking at the water bills, yes, they can understand that, but maybe if they hear it.
Basically, the base rate of the water bills, and I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but the water rate has just, or the sewer rate just increased another 5%, and people will see it in next month's bill. So the new minimum is $52.15. That is for your first three units of water is $16.43, and the new sewer rate is $35.72 for your single family residence, your multiple family residence. That covers you for 10 units of your water use, and then it goes up $3.19 for each additional unit above 10 that you use. For single family condos, that covers you for your first three water uses of water. Three units of water is your $35.72, and then it goes up your $3.19 for each additional unit that you use. And Dylan can verify this for me, that they've set the base rate at 10 units because majority of your water is for your household use, and they take your landscaping into consideration. So they have it at a higher bracket of your water use being to 10 units, that base rate to cover the landscaping and all the uses of your water that do not involve the sewer.
So I'll tag in and make sure that's clear. Your base water rate gets you so many units of water. It gets you the three units of water. Your base sewer rate gets you your first 10 units of water usage. And the reason we do that is because we don't directly meter the sewage. We use your water.
And I know that it says it's tied to low-income residents. I mean, our city could be asking people to show that they have low-income issues to get this discounted rate. And then if you're not a low-income resident, if you don't qualify for that, then you have to pay the $38.50 because that is the real cost to get the water to our homes. And I don't think the city's going to change their policy, but I just think that people don't think about the fixed cost, as you called it at one point, of just having water available to our homes. All the infrastructure that goes in that everybody has to share. Everybody has to pay because we live here and we want to have fresh water available to our homes. And the city isn't making a profit on that. So, in fact, they're losing money on all those accounts that are paying the $16.43. So I think it would be great to have this information in the water bill, at least, you know, maybe once a year or something, so that people, if they're not watching tonight, and I know everybody isn't, it would give them an opportunity to understand the difference between usage costs and fixed costs. Because I think Bill did a great job of explaining it in here. And that's what I just wanted to draw attention to that, too, because people just don't always understand how expensive it is just to get things that we take for granted every day to our homes. You know, we don't see those water lines that come all the way from the San Joaquin Valley or the contract with the state water that we have to pay for every year. So I don't know if it's an appropriate time to make a motion have this included in the water bill.
The thing that a lot of people don't think about is that fire hydrant that's nearby. Mm-hmm. That's got larger bore pipe to it, to deliver at least 1,000 gallons a minute. You know, and that keeps your insurance rates down.
And protects our homes.
And some of the hydrants in town are 2,000 gallons a minute. Mm-hmm.
If I could chime in here, Dylan, in terms of, in a way, I guess the city is subsidizing some water usage. I don't know
that's
if that's a fair assessment. I mean, I guess semantics aside, you might be able to say that. So, because I understand the tiered system, and I think people that live in the city on fixed income, not just necessarily low income, but seniors, this is helpful. Who makes up the difference? Does that come from the general fund?
No, actually. The general fund does not subsidize water use. What happened? The thing I like to point out here is we haven't changed water rates since 1995. The water rates have not gone up since 1995. Just the rate for your wastewater. So that's a long run in the life of a water rate. Not very many communities have been able to do that. And I look ahead, you go, eventually we're going to get to the point where we're going to need to look at that and talk about water rates, but we're a couple years down the road still. So I don't see that coming immediately, but I do see it, in the next 5 years, I think we'll probably have some discussions about that. When we get into those discussions, you have to step back and say, okay, well, what is the purpose and intent of my water rate? From my perspective, the primary purpose of the water rate is to provide enough revenue so that the city can provide water. I mean, that's sort of the fundamental purpose of the water rate, is to have enough revenue so that we can pay that bill for state water contracts, so that we can have some people on staff to deal with and keep the water coming into the system. In 1995, when they put this rate structure in place, it actually was fairly progressive. The thought was is that this is a conservation-oriented and based rate structure. So the more water you use, the more it costs you. It's been very effective. So you go, if you look around the state at water usage, Morro Bay has one of the lowest water usages in the state on average per capita. So you guys are feeling horrible about your 10 units. You go over in Atascadero, the average use in the summer is 25 units. I mean, we're doing pretty good, generally speaking, as a community on water conservation. A large part of that is that you go, it costs you. If you want to be a water hog here, you're going to pay for it. And so you go, this rate structure was put in place so that it would encourage that conservation. What it does, though, is as you put in place a conservation-based rate structure, you do shift costs. So you shift costs from the low-end user, low-water user, to the larger water users. So the general fund doesn't make up for that. There's no subsidy from the tax rolls paying for water usage. The water usage pays for itself, but the big water users largely pay the costs for the small water user. And you go, I didn't go through and kind of do a dollar and cent analysis of what Bill had put together here, but largely our costs here in Morro Bay are fixed costs. By and large, most of the costs we incur are fixed. So whether we deliver one drop of water to the city or deliver a billion gallons.
By people that are using excessive amounts of water as large amounts of water, and probably excessive, maybe.
I don't want to say excessive.
Okay. Well, above what Bonnie is saying the average is. Because of our rate structure.
Yeah, you look at the commercial users. So you go think about like a hotel where they do laundry every day, sheets, bedding, towels. So a lot of the hotels use large quantities of water. It's not excessive for what they're doing with it. And so you go those. A lot of times it's commercial accounts that actually wind up subsidizing the residential accounts in this case.
So this billing structure that we're looking at, this is for residential and commercial as well. We're all on the same rate structure.
Correct. Mm-hmm. For water. Mm-hmm. For wastewater, there's a separate rate structure.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
I just did the math for someone who has a water usage of 3 and their charge is $16.43 versus the cost to the city of $39.70. If half the households were actually paying the cost of those 3 units usage, it would be a difference of $63,992 a month.
I was thinking along the same lines. It's about $20 in account savings, it looks like, that they're paying under what it actually costs.
Yeah, it's $23.27.
Mm-hmm. But in the big picture, is the water on an enterprise fund?
Yeah.
So it's out of general funding.
Yeah. So
it's aside from general funding. So we come out at the end of the year, it doesn't cost us any more to provide and bring in water than we're collecting from the users, correct?
Generally speaking, that's correct. So you might have a real high water usage year where we might run over. We might have a big capital project one year we might run over. Mm-hmm. But the way that's a good point, though. The way that the enterprise fund works, so water is an enterprise fund, wastewater is an enterprise fund, the harbor is an enterprise fund, and the transit is an enterprise fund, which is the dollar that you see. The way the enterprise funds work is that they collect – so the water – bill that you pay goes for the sole purpose of providing water. It doesn't go to fixing potholes on the street. It doesn't go to providing police protection. It doesn't go to providing firefighters. That money is collected specifically for the purpose of the water system. and we use those revenues. They get reinvested back into the water system. And so on an every year basis, we land really close to balancing. You might have, you know, if we did a big project 1 year in the water department, we might burn more money than we brought in. But our goal is we're not for profit, right? I mean, you know, this is government functioning to the benefit of the citizens in the purest sense, and that you go, there is no sort of profit motive. There's no reason to collect more revenues than we need. And so you go, we try to balance that fairly closely, where we keep a little reserve so that we have a kind of a rainy day account. But you don't want that. So if our reserves were building up, if we were just basically putting in tons of money every year into our bank account, eventually somebody would come and rap us on the knuckles and say, hey, you can't do that. We don't save it. So you go, it basically all gets expended in doing the business that we need to do. So yeah, it does. It kind of balances out at the end of the year.
Though, for certain maybe projects that are being planned for the future, that $770,000 a year, could that be applied to water infrastructure projects or improvement?
Yeah, so as I talked about it, you go, at some point we're going to have to come back and readdress our water rate structure. Granted, this rate structure was put in before Prop 218. So as we go through that process, it will require a vote of the people. It can be a negative option vote. But we do have to go through, and we will certainly, when we get to that point, have those discussions. So as I look down the road and say, okay, here are the projects that I'm kind of working on, and I've been putting a lot of time and effort and money into our brackish treatment in our desal plant. We've got some issues that we'll talk about here in a few minutes out in Choro that, you know, I'm not sure what the fix is going to be, but, you know, anytime you start talking water fixes, they're not cheap. So as I look down the road, you go, I can eventually see the point where you're going to say, okay, our revenue stream isn't enough anymore to cover the capital component of what we're trying to do. Right? So maybe we can cover our fixed costs, but we're not putting any money aside for these projects that we want to get done. And at that point in time, so when we sort of sit down and do that analysis and say, okay, I think in a year or two or 3 years, we're going to pass that tipping point where we're no longer collecting enough revenue, then we'll come back and propose a new rate structure, and we'll have some great discussions about this topic, and then we'll look to modify the water rates.
The infrastructure cost to deliver that?
That actually in 1999, which was well before when I started at the city, but I've reviewed that report, the city did a very comprehensive reclaimed water study. I believe Crowell Engineers did that in 1999. I have a copy of it. I only have one, so I won't loan it out, but you're welcome to come take a look at it. And that was precisely the sort of the deterrent to doing reclaimed water here in Morro Bay, is that you need the infrastructure. So you go, okay, well, we want to distribute, you know, dual water system where you get potable water and reclaimed water, and you can use the reclaimed water in your landscaping and reduce our demands on our potable system. There are certainly some huge benefits to a community to putting in a reclaimed water infrastructure. But you know, that infrastructure is a phenomenally expensive investment because you're digging down through streets that are already full of pipes, that are already paved, that are already put in. And so you go, that really, it didn't pencil out from an economic standpoint. And I would imagine that if we did that study again today, that's the same result that we would find. But that is something that we will look at. We are going through an upgrade on our wastewater plant, and we're going to tertiary treatment. And once we've made that jump, then that will enable us to more readily go to reclaimed water in the future.
Anyone else? If not, all right.
I would like to make a suggestion that this report that Bill did would go into water bills, maybe, you know, not exactly this form, but in some type of maybe simplified, shortened form. I think it's important information that all our water users could benefit from reading. So do I need to make a motion on that? Okay. Is that a possibility then?
Yeah, I've taken pretty good notes. A couple things that we've wanted to cover. We talk about doing those newsletters quarterly. We don't always get around to it. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that's easy to have fall off of our workloads. But I thought I would put something in there about low water use. There's a way that you can read your meter on the newer meters. It'll tell you if you have a small leak that's constantly going. Mm-hmm. So I thought I would put some information on that and then some basic water rate information in there as well.
One of the things I think would really be helpful is to give people an idea of what you think a typical usage would be so that they know, well, how come, you know, we're higher. Maybe there's something we need to check into in our family's use.
You bet.
Okay.
On the water bill, there might be a way, this is just a suggestion, maybe instead of putting an insert, which can be a whole other project, there might be a line somewhere. There's no place to insert a tip or a note or a message onto the bill itself, no?
It's very limited. There's about 25 to 30 characters that I have, and I need to put the notes like, you know, penalties will be assessed, and those kind of notes have to go in before water conservation. So.
What about the back side of it?
The bills are pre-printed about 6 months in advance as far as, like, the basics of it. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. when it's printed with your detail on there, it's printed monthly. But Mills does our printing for us, and it would increase our costs about $600 to $800 per month to do that.
Oh, to do a two-sided bill?
Yeah.
Well, then the newsletter sounds like a good option.
Yeah,
you can put more detail.
We'll put a newsletter together. We're getting past due, I would say, on that.
Okay, everybody satisfied?
I just want to say thank you again, Bill.
Yeah, thank you, Bonnie.
And Bonnie.
And thank you, Bonnie, for coming.
So you may go home to your family now. Okay, and then we'll proceed with, go back and have the director's report.
I'll just say on the director's report, I don't have anything to highlight this month, so if you guys want to go ahead and just we'll take any questions you have and then move on.
This is
yes. Dylan, I did have a question about the flood zone analysis. I did read something about that. Could you tell why? Isn't that kind of a huge thing there?
It is kind of a huge thing. That's an understatement of the year. Let me kind of get my arms around this and how I want to march forward with it. As part of the environmental impact report for the wastewater treatment plant project, one of the things that we had to look at was impacts on the flood zone. We knew that the plants in a flood zone, wastewater plants in California, I would say probably 85 or 90% of them are built in a flood zone. The reason that is that you're trying to get everything to flow to your plant by gravity. So what do? You go pick the lowest point in town. That's where you build your wastewater plant. But that also almost always happens to be flood zone. Well, it's cheap land, so it makes sense, I guess, from that perspective. And so people build in the flood zone. We knew that the plant was in a flood zone all along. So we hired a consultant to come in and to start to do that analysis. So we learned that it was actually a flowing condition. So think of the water flowing down your gutter. If you step in there, you all know you're going to get a wet pant leg, right? Because that water's coming down the gutter, and you go, it'll back up against you. So that strategy of putting in a flood wall then under that flow condition isn't such a good strategy anymore, because you now have a fairly large impact on the neighboring properties. So this is an issue that only really has been discovered the last few months. We've taken it to the Joint Powers Authority, which is the board that governs the wastewater plant. It's Morro Bay Cayucas' wastewater plant. We've taken it to them. It went last, I guess it was probably 3 weeks ago now. It's coming back to them again on September 10th. They're going to look at it. They haven't taken any action. But staff's recommendation to them has been to actually physically move where the plant is located and shift it a little bit towards the south. There's an area. You drive down Atascadero Road and you think of it as being flat, but it's really not. There's an area where there's some trailer storage right now that's actually significantly higher than the plant site. It's about 4 or 5 feet higher on average than the plant site is. So if we built the new plant in that location, it would be mostly out of the flood zone, and then we could flood-proof that facility and not cause the impact. So that was staff's ultimate recommendation. They haven't taken action on it, so I don't know exactly where we're going to land yet. But it is a big issue. What I tell everybody, though, is that you go, when you do a big project like a wastewater plant, you uncover big issues. Every project has big issues. Hopefully this is the biggest one that we have to get through. But at the end of the day, I think it's a solvable problem. I think we have a solution on the table that's probably doable and isn't going to greatly increase the cost of the plant or anything like that. So, but it remains to be seen. We just kind of have to work through it.
I'm really glad this issue was brought up tonight. I think it's a huge issue, or it's a huge discussion, let me just say. And it's almost on the same line of being given a really bad diagnosis at your doctor's office and wondering if a second opinion has been sought for this.
Yeah, we've hired the original engineer that was hired to do the facilities master plan was Corello Engineers. We brought in Wallace Group to do the flood study. That study's been reviewed by Rob Livick, PE, myself, PE, Mike Nunley from Boyle, who's the Cayucas's engineer, PE. So you go, it's been well pushed through, and as we've worked through it, we actually worked through probably 30 iterations to finally come up with the recommendation that we made. So we went through all sorts of scenarios on how are we going to make this work and came to the recommendation that we did.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. Wondering if alternate sewer treatment systems have been looked at, permeable membrane systems?
Yeah, we did, actually. When we came back and said, okay, because we basically said, here's the recommendation that we've been given. We've been given direction by that board that we're pursuing a tertiary upgrade with an oxidation ditch technology. We stepped back and said, okay, well, what's the footprint that you can get that's smallest, right? So you go, what's your smallest footprint? And it's probably a membrane bioreactor process. We took a look at that, but the costs of doing the membrane bioreactor process outweigh the benefits of the smaller footprint. So you go, basically, that the technology costs you more than it would cost you to move some extra dirt around and get more out of the floodplain.
Yes, that is probably true, but doesn't that type of plant reclaim all of its water?
No.
No?
No. It would be, so the project that we're considering right now is tertiary treated water for ocean disposal.
Okay. And then just the other thought that I have, what you say is accurate about moving dirt, possibly until you consider the value of the dirt that you're moving it onto. As a professional real estate agent, that is prime beachfront property.
And that's the hot discussion that remains to be had between Morobay and Cayucas.
Yeah, and I'm that's all. I'm just glad it's being discussed because I think a lot of discussion is good.
Any other? If not, we'll proceed to the next item, which is the on the new business, the presentation.
Well, actually, Bill, I do have some questions about the. I thought you meant about that item on the director's report. I do have some questions. Dylan, on the first page of the director's report, the collection system.
It's broken a couple times on us. So ultimately, we're going to want to replace that pipeline. What we've done, the bypass pump, is actually just a redundancy feature for the lift station. And so it's an ability to bypass. You could pump from a manhole out in the street, bypass the lift station, and you're still using that same pipeline to push the sewage up the hill.
And I guess that was put into place given the failure that we had in the last year with that lift station?
Yeah, we've had a number of problems down there, a couple near misses, one fairly spectacular near miss where we flooded the part that's supposed to be dry got very wet is the way that I will describe that. So that made for a really long couple of evenings and days for our crews. So we put in a bypass pump so that we just basically – I'm a big believer – on wastewater systems, on water systems, of having a little bit of redundancy and having some flexibility. So you go, okay, if this motor catches on fire and burns up, what am I going to do? And you go, okay, well, I can hook a pump up here or one up there and get it around this way. So we're always trying to build a little bit of redundancy in. into the systems that we design. So this bypass is just basically a redundancy feature.
I understand. That's kind of what I thought. And do those bypass features exist on the other lift stations throughout the city?
Yes. Lift station 1 has a bypass. Lift station 2 doesn't have a bypass for the lift station, but it has two pumping lines. So it also has some redundancy there.
What's the location of one, the number one
sure.
lift station?
Lifts, I'll give you all three.
I've got
lift station number 1, you really don't see it. It's below grade on the east side of the access road at Cloisters Park. So if you're driving into Cloisters, there's a little, all you can see of it is the electrical control box. So there's a little shiny metal box that you see kind of over there by itself. That's our lift station number 1. Lift station 2 is tucked discreetly in the intersection of Surf Street and Front Streets. So if you've gone down and had breakfast at the French Cafe down there, the bakery, it's basically right across the street from GAFCO. And it's in the harbor yard. So the harbor has a little yard there. You see the green fence kind of tucked in the corner. That's where lift station 2 is. And then lift station 3 is on the corner of South Bay Boulevard and Quindana.
So lift station 1 handles all of the north end of Morro Bay, then, it sounds like?
Most of North Morro Bay, everything on the east side of the highway flows to our plant by gravity. That's the one benefit of sort of the topography that we have. You kind of climb up the hill, so it just flows down the hill and flows into the plant by gravity. The west side of the highway, which is the Beach Subdivision Cloisters, because of where they're at and how low they are, you really would have a difficult time making gravity work. I don't want to say it'd be impossible because they looked at it at one point in time, but it was not very convenient. And so you go, lift station 1 serves that west side of the highway. Lift station 2 serves really all of this end of Morro Bay. So everything from about Surf Street all the way to the State Park is lift station 2 because it flows downhill to the Embarcadero, and then we run it all down along the Embarcadero on gravity and pick it up at lift station 2 and pump it to the plant.
That's that deep pit down there.
Yeah, it's a very deep pit. Actually goes below sea level. And then lift station 3, is, if you think about, you're driving on Quintana and you just came off Morro Bay Boulevard, turned right on Quintana, headed down the hill, right about the mortuary, you have a pretty steep break in the hill and you head down that hill. Lift station 3 serves the trailer parks and then the rest home, Casa de Flores, that's in that vicinity. So basically lift station 3 takes that little section of Morro Bay, pushes it up the hill, dumps in it at Morro Bay Boulevard, and then it goes by gravity from there to the plant.
I guess since we're talking about lift stations, and I know it's not on the director's report, the state park with back in the marina and the state park, do they pump up to us and then we get that at lift station 3? Or no, that would go to lift station 2?
2. It goes to lift station 2. So they pump to us, and then they basically pump it into a manhole on Main Street. And then from there, it flows to lift station 2.
So they're responsible from their sewage collection to the manhole right probably at the break of the city?
Yep.
And that feeds into our system?
You got it.
And what about the high school?
The high school has a gravity line that feeds into our system. They're responsible, from where I sit, they're responsible for their facilities. So you go, everything in the high school driveway basically runs, their trunk line runs down the driveway. I don't know where it goes after that. That's their facility.
And do they compensate the city for that?
They pay a wastewater rate. Think of it as just a large lateral. So you go, the state park pays for their water usage, and they use us for their potable water. And then they pay wastewater rates on that water usage. So it's just a large lateral. And there are a number of individual homes in Morro Bay that have lift stations. Stormwater improvements and some of the stormwater efforts that the city's been required to go through. So Measure Q is being put to good use, not just in terms of the fire department. The way that the city intends to pay for the construction of the second phase of the fire station, the first phase was paid for largely out of disaster relief funds because the original fire station was damaged in the San Simeon earthquake. The second phase isn't going to be. So we basically kind of we took that as far as we could in the first phase. So the city will be paying for all of this second phase. The way that they're intending to do that is a couple of mechanisms. What we're actually trying to do, we're chasing a grant right now. That's one thing that city staff's very good at, that we're always out there digging around, trying to see if we can pull in somebody else's money to do our projects with. So we're chasing a grant. If we get the grant would potentially cover a large portion of that. If we don't get the grant, the plan is that we're going to take out a loan from the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture. They have the ability to loan loans to cities like ours, small communities, at fairly great interest rates. And so we'll get a very good interest rate. So the city would borrow that money, and then they would pay for it out of the Measure Q funds, which is the tax that we put on ourselves over time. And then also the city owns a parcel on San Jacinto right there, the kind of in the cloisters, that the sale of that parcel, the proceeds from that sale, will be used to pay for this second phase as well.
So in the time that we would pay for the design of the firehouse, get the loan from USDA, we use monies to maintain the cost or the payments on the interest of that loan, hoping that that property sells.
You got it. And if it, let's say it never sold, then we would just basically pay down that loan as time went along.
I believe that property was at one time designated for fire station development. That's why the money would go to that fund.
Yeah, it was. That property was granted in the development of the cloisters to put an emergency services building there. There were a number of reasons that it was determined that that wasn't the best site for the fire station. Not centrally located was one of the big reasons, also because of some of the special hazards that are in being that close to the ocean.
Dylan, I have another question about the state water. Usually with the drought buffer that the city has, if the state water delivers, I think, what we say, 33% of what our agreement is, we're good with the amount of how many acre feet we need per month. When it says right here we've had it increased to 35%, that really is just kind of window dressing because we already have what we need?
There again, I don't like to feel like I'm giving you guys squirrely answers, but things are just always more complicated than they appear at face value. The county actually, in the last few years, has instituted a dry year program. In the dry year program, once water deliveries get below a certain percentage, I think it's either 60 or 40%, I don't remember off the top of my head, then we can participate in that program. We did do that at the beginning of this year, because at the beginning of this year, deliveries were less. They were at 25%. So we told the county, hey, we'll buy some water from you out of this dry year program. Once deliveries go up, though, past that 33%, I'm not sure it's exactly 33%, but let's use that number. Once they go up past 33%, then we can participate in the dry year program not as a buyer but as a seller, because we have a little bit of paper water that we can sell back to them. So we can never get more than 13 acre feet of water in wet water. So yeah, we cannot get more, and that breaks down to 109 acre feet per month, and we can't get more than that. So in the summer months, our demands are usually higher, so state water doesn't cover all of our demand in the summer months. Every fall, state water goes off for a shutdown. That's coming up later this year in either October or November. And so you go, state water isn't interruptible. So we get by, though. We can never get more state water than we've contracted for. The county can give us a little bit. Maybe we can get a few extra acre feet one month, but a little bit less the next month. There's a little bit of flexibility there, but not really. So at the end of the year, we get 13 acre feet. Years above 35% but below 60% could be good for us, because by participating in that program, we could sell some water back.
So let me just make sure I'm clear. It's 13, and we sometimes get close to using all that?
Yeah, we use very close to all of that.
And then if I'm just thinking about those 50% of the households that are only using 3 units, and what if all of those households were using what we are over here determining is the average, which is 15 units or 12 units? What would happen?
We'd be in a lot of trouble. From my perspective, it would be horrible. Vacation house or whatever it is. So you go, that's the day of the year that our system is designed around. So we're designed to produce that peak amount of water and deliver it. Most days of the year, we don't have to do that. And so you go, most of the time, we have a little bit of reserve capacity. So we could call and get more state water, or we could produce a little bit more. But we really you design your water system around producing that peak. So we could support maybe 18,000 people for a couple of days. But you go, to have a permanent population like that, then with those visitor peaks on top of it, our system isn't designed for it. And so you go, if everybody's water demand and usage has jumped up tremendously, we would be in a world of hurt.
I'm not suggesting that we would do this, but what comes to mind is the new drivetrain and the desal plant. Isn't that looked at as the backup system in case of great need or breakdown of part of the system?
You look at it from a water supply perspective. You kind of go through what are probable emergencies. And so you go, okay, well, what would we do? And let's say there was a big earthquake on the San Andreas Fault, and that pipeline that brings us water out of the State Water Project was interrupted. You go, okay, well, what would we do then? In that case, we'd be stuck relying on our groundwater wells and then the desal plant. So you go, you run through those scenarios, and you do a little bit of advanced planning and say, okay, well, how would I deal with that? Now you go, well, what would I do if there was a 10.0 earthquake in Morro Bay? Well, you go, well, everything goes out the window. I don't know what I would do, right? And you go, there are scenarios that could occur that you really can't plan for. But you go, you do sort of plan for some of the routine, sort of credible scenarios and say, okay, well, we're not going to have the biggest fire we ever had on the day that the State Water Project is down and the day that my three wells are out because of contamination. You kind of don't plan like that. That would be too redundant. But you do sort of look at some of those things and say, okay, it's good to have more than one water supply. And we do have that. We have the desal plant, the groundwater wells, and state water. So we have sort of a three-legged horse is the way that I would describe it. But anytime you lose one of those legs, we certainly are impacted. And it makes it tricky for us to provide water.
Isn't one of the drawbacks of looking at desal, if it had to be a long-term solution, is that it's extremely expensive for the city? I know Bill mentioned it in his water report, that the electricity is very expensive. And also, we have to deal with the brine as well. And I don't know what the plan is for that. And I know we use it in such small usage now that it's not a big issue, the cost or the brine?
The brine we dispose of via an ocean outfall that we share with Dynegy. So we basically share the outfall with a power plant, and our brine is discharged at that location. We have a permit for that. Actually, one of the big things that we're working on is revising that permit, and we're trying to reduce the amount of testing we have to do on that effluent from the plant. So if that's successful and goes through, we'll have to do less testing and our costs to operate that facility will go down. Another thing that we're working on, so there's three components to the big cost of running the desal. One, we don't run it enough right now to make it worth keeping somebody on staff that knows how to do that. So we don't basically employ a desal plant operator all the time because you go, we only use it 2 weeks out of the year, and the rest of the year that guy would be sitting twiddling his thumbs. So one of the big measures that I'm working on right now is actually we're revising the water job descriptions and trying to get all of our guys trained on that facility so that we can run it with our own staff rather than a contract operator. And then there's the energy usage, but the energy usage is significantly less for the brackish system that we've installed than is for the saltwater system. And so you go, in the future, I would anticipate that we're going to be running that facility more and more and more and more. We especially want to do it in the short term because we're trying to flush nitrates out of the groundwater basin in Morro. And so you go, we're planning on this. So there's three or four different pieces to that puzzle that we're working on to reduce those operating costs significantly. So they'll be half of what they once were once all of these pieces have kind of come together.
But if it was used as a desal... Thank you. If it was used as a desal system instead of a brackish water treatment facility, it is very expensive electricity-wise. Is it more so for the desal than for the brackish? That's what I think you're saying.
Significantly more for the desal than the brackish. And we looked at there are techniques that we could put in place to reduce the energy usage of the current desal system. but we're not desalting enough water that the capital costs would ever be recovered. So there is an energy recovery system that you can put on there, and we actually had planned on doing it this year. But we sat down and looked at the recovery period, and you go, okay, well, it was 108 years before we would recover that capital expense. So the way that we're using it now, it doesn't make sense to try to reduce that operating expense. As we move into the future, though, I could see us getting to the point, let's say 5, 10, 15 years down the road, where you go, it might make sense for us to revisit that issue and 8, 10, whatever street it is, and he'll get that message.
I have. Can I go back to the floodplain conversation for just one moment?
Sure.
I can? Thank you. Yep. What is the likelihood of this 100-year flood? Have we ever had a 100-year flood?
It's the 1% probability of exceedance in a given year is how you define that. So in any given year, it has a 1% chance of occurring. To my knowledge, since Morro Bay has been populated, the 100-year flood has never occurred.
The one in 1995 was fairly close.
The 1995, based on some of the analysis we've done, was more like a 25 or 30-year return period event. It was not the 100-year event. So the 100-year event would dwarf that one.
Exactly, because it
was pretty. The question I have from an engineering perspective is, where's this water coming from, and is it possible to catch it upstream? Or these floods, they're not flash floods. We kind of, in California, know when the rain is coming, and we kind of know, and how many days does it take to accumulate that amount of water to flood like that?
Actually, in our watershed, because you go think about the Morro Creek watershed. So if you're driving to Atascadero, how far do you get before you actually crest that hill and start coming down the other side? You go half that trip. So basically, when you crest, is the end of our watershed. So that watershed is fairly steep and fairly concentrated. So our flood, 100-year flood event, actually would be much more similar to a flash flood, where you go, that watershed got hit fairly hard. It would fill up rapidly. It would accumulate fairly quickly because there's not a lot of storage sites. I mean, you go, it's those nice vertical rocky hills that would shed water fairly quickly. And so you go, in our case, the flooding event would be fairly severe, but also short-lived. So we wouldn't be underwater for days and days and days. It would mow through. It would do all its damage in a day or two, and then you would have to kind of dig out and clean up.
I guess my point is, yeah, it would come through fast, but we kind of know there's conditions under which something like that might occur. Like, we're going to have a 4 or 5 front storm system coming through in 2 or 3 days. Is there any way to capture the water upstream, or given those kind of lead times, prepare or something?
You always try to prepare for it. We have the unique scenario, actually, where the highway in that vicinity, so at Morro Creek, it actually chokes off the flow. Think of Main Street and then the highway right next to it. As you're driving on Main Street, you see the highway bridge right there. That bridge serves as a natural choke point. And it actually will back water up. It will flood everywhere east of Main Street. And then the water relieves itself by coming down Highway 41 and Atascadero Road. So it's a fairly small and concentrated area that you go, there really isn't a good solution as far as you just don't have a lot of strategies available to deal with it.
And also, I don't know how far back city records go, but even though there's only a 1% chance per year, if we haven't had that kind of flood in 100 years, the chances of it happening are increasing every year that goes by, that we will have that type of... Is that not right?
No. With earthquakes, that is true. With a flood, it's just a 1% chance in a 100-year period. Oh. But what happens... As we've found, so the Katrina event in New Orleans, some of the big flooding that happened, we do sometimes find that our engineering estimates aren't correct, and you have to come back and revise those.
Are not.
So it does occasionally happen where even engineers make mistakes, and you see an event that's bigger than the 100-year flood event, and then you go, oh, well, I guess we have to revise what our definition of a 100-year flood event is.
Well, my question is, though, when you say that there's only a 1% chance per year, it makes it seem like it's an insignificant chance that it could happen. And then when in your planning, why would you plan for something that has the odds of 1 to 100?
That's actually the design condition that you design for. So you don't design your flooding facilities. That's not your. You don't design your system to pass that. You might design your system to pass a 10 or a 20-year event without some flooding occurring. But when you do design your facilities and structures and critical infrastructure, you do want it to survive that event in case it does happen. Because you go, just because it's a 1 in 100 probability, it doesn't mean that it couldn't happen this winter, for example. You know, people win the lottery all the time. In this case, it would be like 1 in 100 chance of winning a very bad lottery.
The question is about the flood and how the potential flood and how it would potentially affect the open basin tubby sewer treatment-y sections. Is there any way, if you know, like, we're going to have a, there's, we're, you know, this is.
And so you go, that manhole's potentially under 12 feet of water. In your 100-year flood event, you go, I would seriously doubt that spillage from our wastewater treatment plant would be a major concern to anybody. That kind of event would do so much damage, it would scour so much material that you go, you couldn't take samples upstream and downstream of the wastewater plant and find a difference.
Wow, that's really interesting. Because, yep.
We only have a half hour left.
Okay.
We have plenty to go.
Okay. That's very interesting because we're, okay, thanks.
Except I would just, the only little comment I'd like to add is that maybe in the ocean there it would make a difference to have that sewage ending up in the ocean, even though that is downhill from the human population, the marine life might feel those effects.
Well, and the cost of moving the plant is like $27 million.
Mm.
And if it's not going to make a difference.
Okay, we're finished. Then we'll proceed to item 9B, presentation on the Ashurst Well Field Nitrate Study, which is actually the Choro Creek Basin, right?
Yeah, so you can call it the Choro Nitrate Study if that's more comfortable to you. We actually looked at and we're looking at the Ashurst Well Field. I'll blow right through this so we can have most of the time for you guys to ask me some questions. We're not taking any action on this tonight. This is intended to be an informative presentation just to make people aware of it. First and most important thing I want to point out is here on the bottom of the screen, on the city's website, this whole document is there. So I don't know exactly how many pages it is. I think it's 170 pages or something like that.
That's what it says on my thing, too.
313.
It's 313. Okay, there you go. So it's 313 pages. So there are there's a ton of information there. There's a bunch of appendices. I didn't bother printing copies for everybody. We wanted to save a forest or two.
You can print it out.
But you can take it home. I wouldn't even recommend you print it out. I would just download it. It's a PDF file, so you should be able to download it. It's not going to mess up your computer or anything. And then you can, if you're interested in some of the technical analyses, you can dig through those. I didn't plan on grinding through those kind of analyses tonight. So you go, you guys can take, breathe a sigh of relief. We'll just kind of go through it in general terms, and then I'll let you guys ask any questions you might have. So where is this at is probably the first question. Where is Ashurst Wellfield? It's right here is the short answer. This is Highway 1 running north. So you go, this is South Bay Boulevard running down through here. This is the road cutting through the state park. So the high road, the low road down through state park, South Bay coming down here. So basically Highway 1, you have that little turn off at the end of Quintana where you can get on the freeway. So if you miss it at South Bay Boulevard, you can go straight on down through. We're basically right in there. This is Choro Creek Road. Our Ashurst well field is centered in and around Choro Creek Road. So that's just sort of basically where you sit in the world. This is a sort of a bigger map. What it shows here is it actually shows the wetted area of the Choro Aquifer. And so Choro Creek Road is down here. That's the Ashurst Wellfield. This is Highway 1. There again, a good reference. Kinney Road is right about here. So here's the hill, basically sitting right here. And then this is going on into San Luis. So as you can see, this is a fairly small watershed, again, as far as what's aquifer. A lot of people, when we start talking about aquifers and watersheds and groundwater, they have a different vision in mind. The way our aquifer works is it's basically the alluviums of the creek and the areas between the hills is really what our aquifer is that we're talking about here. So this is why we have an issue. And what this is, that line, this is kind of small, so I apologize to all of you. That line that you see is the drinking water standard. So you go, this is the wells that are upstream. This is the Romero well field by Kinney Road. And you can see that your nitrate levels hop around. We had some events back in the 80s where they jumped up above the standard. They've come back down, and they sort of are holding fairly low. So we see single-digit to 20s sort of routinely in my period of time in history here in Morro Bay. So this is upstream at Kinney Road. This is downstream. This is two of the wells downstream at Ashurst. So you can see sort of same timeline. We had these events kind of back in time. But now look at where we're charting. So we're charting 100 parts per million, 110 parts per million. So we've had this issue with nitrates. And as this came in, you go, okay, well, from historical perspective, you go, okay, well, this was just a one-time spike. So it happened in this time frame. They said, you know, it's just sort of seasonal fluctuation. It's not the end of the world. But in the last few years, 8-9 years, we've seen that we're consistently now staying well above the limit I'm from. And one of the sources can be agricultural or turf fertilizers. Another source of nitrates could be private septic system discharges. Another one could be wastewater treatment plant discharges and overflows. Another one could be an animal operation. So you have somebody who's running thousands and thousands of head of cattle, you could get nitrate from that. And then there are miscellaneous sources. So you do have some naturally occurring background nitrates that will wind up in the groundwater. As organic matter decays, it can leave behind nitrogen. We're never going to have nitrate-free water, and we don't need to. It's okay for us to drink it, but once it gets above a certain concentration, then it can start causing health effects. And so you go, that's just an important point to kind of note out, that we're not trying to get to zero here. We're just trying to get to good enough. So those were the different sources that they went through and analyzed and said, okay, well, here's all the different sources. So they took that data from the previous slide. So they take nitrate concentration trends. They plot little stiff diagrams based on the mineral characteristics of the water. So they said, okay, well, this well looks like this, that well looks like this, this well upstream looks like this. So they can kind of track where the water is coming from. Think of it as like a water fingerprint almost. They actually take fingerprints on the nitrogen. So it's nitrate, nitrogen, and nitrogen-oxygen isotopes. So as the nitrogen breaks down, they can determine and use that to help them kind of determine what the sources is. They look at stable isotopes of the water. So they say, okay, well, where's the water coming from that has the nitrates in it? And then they also look at wastewater because there is a wastewater discharge upstream of this basin. The Men's Colony, the college, they discharge into Choro Creek. So they look at the wastewater and say, okay, well, does that match sort of the constituents that you see in your groundwater? Good news for us is it really doesn't. It's a different water constitution. So you go, they look at all of those things, and you go, they plot diagrams. Okay, well, here's the magnesium, here's the sodium, here's the calcium, and they look at the water, and they use all of these lines of evidence to make judgments about these different potential nitrate sources. And so, you know, it's a fairly complicated and thorough analysis that they do. You get 300 pages out of them. And what's the end result? The end result in this case is that the agricultural fertilizers were found to be the main source. Oh, sorry about that. Were found to be the main source of nitrate contamination at the Ashurst well field. And then they came up with a couple of mitigation strategies. You can either reduce the nitrogen loading from the fertilizer applications, and then you can also deal with it by either treating or blending any water that you produce. And so, you know, that's where we land again. It's very similar to what happened in Morro. At some point, we'll be taking this. I would anticipate sometime in September taking this to City Council to have some discussions with them about that. What I really wanted to do is just sort of roll it out there and say, you know, we hired the people who know more about this groundwater basin than anybody else. They have a history of 20 years of doing studies of this basin. Their depth of knowledge as far as this groundwater basin beats anybody else in the world. So you can't find anybody more expert to do these kind of analyses. They went through, they looked at all the lines of evidence. And so what you do is you do this kind of analysis, you look at everything and you say, well, this is what we know, this is what we're trying to find out. And you sort of study it away and you go, these different lines of evidence point you in a direction. And when they line up and point you in a common direction, then you draw a conclusion. And so the conclusion that these experts drew is that the fertilizers were coming from upstream agricultural users. And so with that, I'll open it up to you guys. If you have any questions about the analysis, I tried not to get into too deep on the technical stuff. I don't think we'd be well served by that. If you have questions, what I will do is probably have the experts from Cleith Harris at the presentation when I give it to City Council. So if anybody does want to dive into isotope degradation and, you know, chemical finger footprinting and things like that, that we can talk about it more intelligently. But I'd be happy to take any questions that you guys have.
I'll go.
Dylan, I can't even think of any agriculture going on back there except for the hay that's grown along there once a year from anywhere from South Bay Boulevard all the way to Cuesta.
There's between Kinney Road and Choro Creek Road, there's a fairly large ranch. They're no longer, so basically as of last year, the truck crop farmer that was leasing it my understanding is that they've left and they're no longer fertilizing it. But up until about last year, they were producing truck crops. They were growing cabbage and other things on that large parcel.
Well, and plus, right on the other side, on San Bernardo Creek, where that old vegetable stand was, they are doing row crops back there.
Yep.
Now, I know that this is, since that's outside of the city limits, this whole basin, there's parts of it within the city limits and part out, and I know that becomes, it's similar to the Morrow Creek. One more question. I know there was another issue in the Chorro Valley right there on a private property with a wastewater, existing wastewater treatment issue. And so no longer is that absolved? We don't think that's where it's coming from?
What we did look at, so there was a specific facility that one of the neighbors had a problem with. It claimed that their septic system was working improperly. I know the county was involved. I actually don't even know what the ultimate resolution of it was. When you step back, you go, could we potentially have had some problem or some contribution from a failed septic system at some of those wells? Yes, we could have. But from a basin-wide perspective, so looking at all that well field in totality, you go, could a single septic system, even a big one, cause that problem? And the fact is, no, it couldn't. And so you go, we ruled that out fairly quickly as the source of the groundwater basin problems, because they're just simply, you can't get enough nitrogen loading out of a septic system to cause this problem in this big of a basin, unless you had a whole lot of densely packed septic systems, which is the problem they have in Los Osos.
My question, Dylan, is, maybe you know this or don't, is there any current legislature for taxing or, you know, it seems, dare I say, criminal to be able to just dump as much as you want into the groundwater?
Criminal might be too strong of a word. There certainly are legal recourses available to the city to pursue stopping this. So you go, there's a theory of trespass that you go, hey, even though you didn't come into the city and damage the city received a damage because of what you did on the outskirts. So you go, your neighbor could throw a rock from his house, break your window, and be found liable for it, even though he never came on your property. Similar kind of thing. So you go, there are legal recourse the city could pursue in this regard.
Have they ever pursued this? And you said that there was a past incident?
Yeah, so we just finished a study probably 2 years ago now, maybe a year and a half ago, on the Morrow Basin, and found the same issue in the Morrow Groundwater Basin. What I've been mostly involved in the Morrow Groundwater Basin is actually the brackish treatment system and sort of a coping mechanism for dealing with this. The city hasn't taken any legal knowledge or legal action in that basin.
But you're still dealing with the repercussions of that
Correct.
Violation?
Correct.
In the Morrow Valley, has there been any modification by farmers, or have we had conversations with the farmers in that area? What was the outcome of that?
Yeah,
I believe
not,
you were going to.
It's not true to the topic that we're talking about tonight, but it's certainly useful information. In the Morrow Basin, there was one entity that was growing all of the truck crops in the lower basin. So they were 98% of the acreage was one entity. They went through based on what we did and at the request of the regional board and did a study. They found that they could cut their nitrate use by 200%. So they basically said, hey, we were using 200% more nitrogen than we think we need to. They're now going through and actually coming up with a management plan, trying to implement those steps and basically do a scientific-based nitrogen application program to reduce that usage. So you go, there has been efforts made there. How long that takes until we see the benefit, I don't know.
Anybody else?
Yeah, to give us a real simple idea of this, maybe on a thing of 1 to 10, how bad is the nitrate pollution in Choro Valley versus Morrow?
If I had to, Morrow has higher concentrations. And to put it in perspective, you go, it's been deemed by the scientific experts that your water is safe to drink up to 45 parts per million of nitrate is NO3. In Morrow, we've seen levels from private wells as high as 300. So basically, I don't know what that works out to be. It's getting late. You know, 6.5 times the limit. In Choro, the highest we've seen is about 120, but that's still almost three times the limit. So you go on a scale of 1 to 10 from a drinking water supply perspective, these are both 10s. They're big, important issues.
I have one comment that an article I read about drinking water, what's the safest drinking water to use in a family home. And I just wonder if you would agree with this. The point of the article was it's better to drink city water because the EPA evaluates all our drinking water before it comes there.
And we've got a plan in place to notify everybody in Morro Bay within a couple of hours that there's a water quality problem if there ever were one. But you go, obviously our goal is never to have to do that. But if it did happen, you go, you would know within hours that there was a problem. That's something that we're required to do by law, by the state, is that we have to have these plans in place, ready to go in case there is a major issue. But you go, certainly the water that is delivered to your home is the best water you can drink. It's best for the environment, and it's best for yourself. So you go, I'm an avid fan of tap water.
Well, what the point of this article was that when you buy bottled water from the store, not only are you wasting resources by purchasing the container and throwing that away, even if you do recycle it, but that water does not have to be evaluated in the same detail that drinking water that comes to our home is evaluated. In fact, if you look on a label of a water bottle, it just says water. And is it true that that water may not have been looked at it and evaluated for safety
it's
EPA
very
requires?
True, that you go, the bottled water doesn't have to meet the same stringent safety requirements that the water that's delivered to your home from the tap does. Mm-hmm. That's very true. And so you go, there are some manufacturers that have voluntary standards. There is some testing that occurs, but you go, it is nowhere near the level that the water that comes to your tap is tested to. So you go, there are, 20 federal rules about what we can do with the water that we deliver to your home. There are about 450 pages of state statutes and regulations that we have to work our way through. And then we have a crew of, right now we have four guys that hold licenses to deliver this water to you. And so you go, it goes through a bunch of tests, and we spend thousands and thousands of dollars a year on testing the water to make sure that the water that you get at your tap is safe to drink. And so you go, I always encourage people to use tap water. Don't waste your money. The water you're getting from the tap is better than the stuff that you're getting from the store.
I know some people question the chlorine content that is used in getting our water to a safer level. And I've noticed at home sometimes I can smell chlorine in the drinking water. This article I read went on to say if that's an issue, then you can buy a reverse osmosis filter for your home water tap. But if it's a system, it does waste a lot of water because to produce 1 gallon of filtered water, often there's 2 gallons of wastewater for that. But
if you don't like the taste of chlorine, then the easy way to deal with it is put your drinking water in a pitcher and let it sit out overnight. You can put it in the fridge, and you go, it will cool down, taste better when it's cold, and chlorine off gases very quickly from water. And so you go, and we use chloramines here, which is a combination of chlorine and ammonia, but you go, some people do not like the taste, and you do get. We do keep a residual. That's intentional. You know, we want the water that comes to your home to be clean and safe. And so you go. We do keep a residual of chlorine in there. But you go. If you don't like the taste, it's really easy. Just leave it out. Put it in a pitcher. Put it in your fridge, and then drink it the next day. And you go. It's fine. That chlorine will off-gas very quickly.
So you don't even think like a Brita. I'm not trying to promote a brand name or anything, but that type of filter where you put it in a pitcher and it pours through a charcoal filter, you don't even feel like that's sitting it out.
Some people, that boils down to some people like the taste a little bit better. You know, there's no accounting for taste. And so you go, if you think the water tastes better after running it through a Brita, that's fine. My one caution to everybody out there is that those in-home systems oftentimes get neglected, and so people don't do maintenance on them. So they buy a charcoal filter, they screw it in under the kitchen sink, they forget about it. 8 years later, when green stuff, slime comes out of their tap, they go, where did this come from? And you go, and so we get the call, and the people say, hey, you're delivering us green slime. You're trying to kill me? And you go, we send our guys out, and our guys check the water at the fire hydrant. They check it coming to their property, and they go, well, let me look under your sink real quick. And, oh, by the way, here's this filter dated 1976 that's been here collecting material since that point in time. And so you go, the one thing to keep in mind if you are going to do a Brita, an RO system, is that all of those systems require maintenance, and it's your health that you're dealing with. And so I encourage you, if you have those systems or are into those systems, do the maintenance that the manufacturer recommends.
Thank you.
That's it. Well, we move on to old business, none. Future agenda items. All we have there really is we've been holding off the San Jacinto intersection for you to return, Matt. So we can do that next month?
Yes, I would like to talk about in the next month
the report on the water system. You know, I went through and kind of skimmed through it. But it was actually already in your packets coming to you before I even did that. You go, so you guys can always bring forward an agenda item if you want to talk about it. In the case of that intersection, Rob Livick's going to, if you want him here, I think we can get him here. But you go, for him, I can't commit him to prepare a staff report or to bring a series of information on that. If you want him to do that, I would say give him a call, ask him if he's willing to discuss it. And then let him put it on the agenda. If you don't want to wait for him, you don't have to. And you can bring anecdotal information. You guys can talk about it. You can formulate a plan and send a letter up to council and say, hey, here's what we recommend you guys do, or have your staff look into this. So you go, that's sort of your role as an advisory board, is to advise the city council about issues that are of interest to you as citizens in the community and related to public works.
And what I would like to do, if it's all right with you, Bill, is do this in October, because what I'll do is I'll write down the concerns that I have that I've talked to people about, and then I'll talk with Rob, and so we'll just keep it as a future agenda.
So you want that hangover till October?
Yes.
And then the bike thing is next. October also, I think.
Yes.
That's what I was Rob's going to be here for that discussion, then maybe Rob could also go over the bike issue that we talked about tonight in some detail.
And this gentleman's going to come in October also, correct?
Okay. Right, yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. So does anybody have something for next month? Do you people have something for next month?
Well, you know, Matt, when we were gone, we were trying to get this pushed through to do it in September, because it's already been waiting about 6 months, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are we able to just... I've got ideas that I'd like to talk about, and I know what they are already. If we can have a discussion about it and get our ideas pooled, and then see what Rob can do about it after that.
Okay, then let's do
this.
Okay.
We'll do that. And then anything else that you might come up with the city there with, so leave it at that, huh?
Okay.
Okay. Then in that case, I guess we're adjourned. Incidentally, you know, that Brian talk.
Don't leave, Jenny.
Hey, John.
Don't leave.
What?
Remember?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Really?
Well, if you have to go to